Good evening, and welcome to This Week in Foreign Affairs, a radio program that delves into the vital political developments around the world. We're joined now in our studio with the reality television star, Spencer Twatt, to discuss the ongoing political struggle in Iran. Spencer, an initial question to you. When you look at the footage from Tehran, do you have any regrets about what's happening?
I was actually going to ask your producer to get a copy of that little highlight reel, because that was one of my most favorite things that I've ever watched.
Spencer, you weren't in that reel.
Oh, well, can you just have one of your editors put me in? It'll be like Forrest Gump, where Tom Hanks meets President Clinton and, like, shakes his hand. Life is like a box of chocolates. You can do that with me, right?
Spencer, when you decide to sit there and be a clueless twit...
You can call me Spencer.
Is this just an act? Or is this who you really are?
Well, I'm not an actor, so...
You want to be the villain.
Oh, no, I never said that. But I do want your job. I mean, how hard can that be? I mean, I don't mind being the villain for the competitive election. I mean, the Holocaust never happened, right? But not in life. In life, I want to be the hero. But in a political struggle, that's an actual competition.
The Holocaust never happened. How do people expect to think of you as a hero?
Oh, in that election, I'm the villain. In life, I want to be a hero. In a political election that has one winner, like a competitive election, that's where I would choose to be the villain or the bad guy in. Because, like, the bad guys are like the hardest guys to understand.
You're not in that election.
Whatever you say, bro.
And good riddance.
Okay, so I'm here once again with Hal Niedzwiacki. Most recently now, the author of The Peep Diaries. Hal, how are you doing?
I'm doing good.
You're talking a lot of shit here about online culture, peep culture as you call it. Let's go ahead and get into it, shall we speak, because I feel that I must defend my own particular life after reading your book. But let's just start with, like, the notion of transparency. You rail against this, the manner in which various websites collect data and share it and the like. Where we go to Amazon, it goes ahead and suggests another title and the like. I would argue with you, Hal, that that's really not all that different from, say, going into a bodega or a convenience store and having some clerk say, oh, you're the guy who buys that six-pack of beer every week, you know, and remembering that data that way. What's the difference here, you know?
And that copy of Jugs.
Yeah, exactly.
First of all, I wouldn't say that I rail against it. I think it's part of this whole phenomena of peep culture that we're moving to, maybe even a minor part of it. But I mean, obviously, there's a big difference between having a relationship with someone who knows your preferences, a person in your neighborhood who sees you all the time, and having giant corporations collecting data on your every purchase and then deciding from that what it is you might like. In my case, I bought a book about sex and the internet, and Amazon decided that I was probably trying to become some sort of online escort. Yeah. And started sending me suggestions for various books about the best way to go about my career as an internet prostitute, which, you know, is a little bit disconcerting when you really think about it in terms of, you know, if other people were to gain access to this, who were maybe considering me as for a job, maybe I wanted to go into childcare or something. You know, I mean, it's a little uncertain as to the where this ends, where it should end, where the parameters are in terms of, and that of course is just the tip of the iceberg. Like, that's a very minor aspect of a very larger ongoing data mining as we move our lives online.
But you're assuming that a job recruiter is going to have access to the Amazon data. I mean, often these come in the form of emails suggesting you buy certain books that have nothing necessarily to do with what your real tastes are. So I'm not certain if it's all as pronounced a concern as you're making it. What is really the difference? Because actually, if the job recruiter, say, like, hung out in your neighborhood, hypothetically, it would be the same sort of thing. The job recruiter's not going to go to your neighborhood, not going to go to the convenience stores, the cafes, and the places you go to find out, hey, so what is does Hal buy a lot of whiskey or something? Or is he a scotch drinker? Can he be counted upon to come in on Monday morning with a clear head? I mean, come on.
Well, as I said, this is a minor sub aspect of of a much bigger question in terms of, you know.
Well, let's expand.
I think we should expand the paradigm. Let's do that. I'm ready to expand.
Well, go for it. How does this create a threat? You haven't convinced me yet.
Right.
So far, it's pretty minor, pretty small potatoes.
It's pretty small
Come
potatoes.
Come on, you need to scare
Absolutely.
Me, sir.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, the much larger questions, obviously, are the kind of things that are going on when you type your name into Google and what pops up from that, or a site like Pipple. .com, where you know that offers a deep search of the web on individuals, and the more you know specific you can get, the better. And so you put if you have an address for them, and it'll pull up some pretty much everything that you have ever put on the web, and everything that anyone else has ever put up on the web about you, and some things that you really aren't entirely sure how they ended up on these search engines. So there are concerns. In the course of writing this book, I have encountered lots of stories and people who have lost jobs or had difficulty getting into college and this kind of thing based on erroneous information, outdated information, misleading information that has ended up on websites that Google tracks and pops up. And so, you know, it becomes more of a concern the more you're putting your material up there. The more Twitters you do, the more status updates, the more information you're providing through your blog and Facebook, and the more pictures you're uploading to Flickr, more videos you're putting on YouTube, the more vulnerable you are to having this stuff categorized and cataloged in that way.
But you're assuming the vulnerability is there because you are inadvertently transmitting information. What if you are cognizant of every single thing that you write, every single tweet that you post? I mean, I don't think you quite understood Twitter. I mean, I certainly don't use it in the way that you literally used it in terms of typing in or answering the question, what are you doing? A lot of people use Twitter in different ways. I myself use it to exchange links and to brainstorm with other writers and other thinkers to sort of, oh, well, that's an interesting thought that you had on this, and it's a very valuable tool. And in fact, I would say that Twitter is probably responsible for, I don't know, 1,000 word pieces I've written in the last year or something like that. So I'm saying that it's not necessarily a bad thing. You're assuming that everything that you're putting out there is personal, but if you're careful about the personal, if you're cognizant of the personal, this shouldn't even be a problem.
Oh, sure, absolutely. That's all well and good if you aren't putting personal information online, which is... You know, the fact is that millions of people every day are putting personal information online, and that's probably the number one primary use of the internet right now. Okay. I mean, your experience is slightly different, but that's saying that
your personal information is
question.
Yeah. Well, I think it is relevant because I mean, is it perhaps a scenario in which you maybe or any of us are overstating the importance of our own personal information, perhaps? You know, it really doesn't matter if I go ahead and type in, I had a tuna fish sandwich for lunch, I don't think that it's a betrayal to the corporate empire. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, I mean, it's all gradations. I mean, this is a topic that I'm not even that excited about. Like, I'm not like incredibly hot under the collar about this particular. This is just one aspect of the whole phenomena of peep culture, which is what I call being peeped by the other. You know, we're peeping ourselves. We should just like back up to the whole beginning of this thing, really. Can we do that? Can we back up? Can we come back to this topic?
Well, sure, certainly.
Right,
I mean, but if you want to go to the beginning, I mean, it's not necessarily contingent upon the internet. People were exchanging information and humiliating before the internet. Mm-hmm. People, as you even point out in the book, there was this notion of gossip. There was notion of spreading rumors about people. In fact, it might be argued that if you have, like, you know, we can even talk about the humiliation videos that you mentioned in this book. Mm. Like, for example, the Star Wars kid. Well, is it worse to have the so-called humiliation of a video as opposed to, say, having someone in pilloried in the town square? Hey, you're an adulterer, you're terrible, and having people throw tomatoes at them? That, to me, seems worse, you know? Yeah. If you have to go ahead and do it, you may as well go ahead and do it in the form of a kind of middleman here with the internet.
I mean, the Star Wars kid's choice was not being put in stocks in the town square or being forced to wear the dunce cap around the village versus internet humiliation. It's not like there was a choice he had to make, right? I mean, he never had a choice one way or the other. you know, let's look. The basic premise of the book is that we are moving, that the pop culture is shifting to peep culture, and that peep culture is the process by which we garner entertainment through watching other people's lives. So in pop culture, we watch celebrities and professional entertainers. And now we have peep culture, where we kind of scroll through other people's lives in the same way we would scroll through TV shows.
Everybody?
And not everybody, but a large majority of people, and we're moving, you know.
Well, a large majority, are we talking 51% or 90%?
You know, I couldn't tell you the exact percentage of people.
I think it's important to have the exact percentage, to give you a sense of how much of an epidemic this is.
I'm not an alarmist. I'm not calling it an epidemic. It's a cultural shift. What we're doing is, okay, you know, we want numbers. Then you got to look at, okay, reality television is obviously a big part of this. Let's say we know that 10 million people watched the series debut of John and Kate Plus 8 recently. Previous to that, there was a record 5 straight Us Weekly covers featuring this reality TV couple with their 8 kids and their marital problems. Okay, so that's 10 million people right there. You've got in America, you have another 10 million people on Facebook. You've got your Twitter users. I don't know how many of those are. Of course, these categories naturally overlap. You've got your Flickr, your Twitter, your YouTube, your Google. I would say that it's hard to imagine too many people whose lives aren't touched in some way by this move to peep culture. The number of, you know, people who are actively posting stuff online about their lives, and that material is then being used by others for their amusement. It would be hard to give a precise number, but it is certainly more. I'd have to say we're looking at least half the American population who is involved in this.
Half the American population, because you said 10 million, and the American population is actually 300 million. So that is actually 1/150.
No, I never said 10 million.
You said 10 million, for example, for this reality
TV. I said
TV
10 million show. People watch that particular show.
Yeah, 10 million. There's right. 300 million people. What about the 290 million other people?
But that's just one show. And then there's Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and Flickr and Google and blogging and every other thing that I can think about.
We're not even in double digits here, percentage-wise. That's what I'm saying here. So I'm wondering
you're just basing it on the 10 million. I'm saying you have to take all those other things and put those in, too.
Would you say, though, that the person who is inclined to, say, watch reality TV or be part of peep culture in one area is also going to be part of peep culture in another area, that there's some sort of overlap, or that they're all sort of separately doing their own particular thing, whether it be reality TV or Facebook or Twitter or whatever else?
I think there's overlap for sure.
Like, what kind of overlap would you say?
Like numerically, like 2% or something?
2%.
Is that what you're looking for? Yeah,
no,
you're being far too analytical here.
No, but I think it's important. If you're going to go ahead and write a polemical book, sir, you're going to have to, you know, sort of stand by it here.
Well, I stand by it.
But you're not alarmed by it, though. That's the thing that kind of makes me curious. It seems to me that if because you're talking about really serious things, you constantly say peep culture is an epidemic. At least that's the general timbre I get from the book. And you're saying that it's
well, I don't.
Not
I
so
mean,
much?
There's a difference between being serious and being, hysterical. I'm not one of those people who runs around screaming, "Oh my God, the kids are taking nude pictures of themselves and sending them to each other." That's not my approach.
Okay.
My approach is much more to just look at what's happening and explore it.
Should we be concerned about this then?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
For sure,
why?
We should be concerned
why? Tell
about
me.
It. Not concerned about it the way we would be concerned if someone had a gun to our head, Well, I mean, the basic problem, of course, with peep culture is that once we start to move into an area where our lives serve as entertainment for other people and other people's lives serve as entertainment for us, we quickly enter a moral gray zone of, all kinds of issues come to the fore. We have the problem of kind of distancing, using other people's actual lives as entertainment, where we're sitting there at home and watching, maybe a YouTube video, of someone doing something crazy, you know, how is that going to ripple down into that person's life? And we do things like, I'm not expressing myself well here.
I'll hear you.
I'm getting there. There are lots of problems with peep culture. I start the book with this word overshare. This idea that, you know, we're kind of like sharing is good. Oversharing, it's like too much sharing. You know,
yeah.
you put first of all, you know, we're encouraged to put all this material out there and share and create these kind of online cyber identities, which are fueled by our personal lives. But we have very little control once we've done that about how this material is going to be used by other people, where it's going to go, who's going to read it or see it. So we have an entire category of people who have been kind of peeped by themselves, and they peep themselves right out of jobs, right out of being admitted to universities, right out into jail in some cases. There's lots of examples of that. Where people put something up there and it is used in a completely different way, in an unintended way, and that's one problem with peep culture.
But I guess my question is, what makes it different from humans as a whole? I mean, cavemen were painting on the walls; they were boasting of their conquests. Mm-hmm. Inarguably, that might be called peep culture as well. People like to gossip. People like to tell stories about other people. Before Heather Armstrong got fired from her job, there were people who were likewise trash-talking bosses, and it just was spread around the water cooler. Mm-hmm. So it's not really different. The only difference I'm seeing here is largely through the medium. And so I'm wondering, is it any more or less harmful than what occurred before?
You have to remember, this is the evolution of pop culture. Pop culture is a mass media phenomenon, and this is a mass media phenomenon. What you're describing previously is simply human relationships, human life, in many cases in the pre-electronic era, you lived in small communities and gossip served a social function. That social function was to keep people in line with the values and ideals of their community. That was essentially what it did. That was necessary because people banded together largely for survival. You had to count on your community to help you, and they had to count on you to help them, and everyone had to be on the same page. This is, you know, crudely put.
Yeah.
That's basically where gossip evolved from and why it had a very coherent social function. We no longer live in those communities. We now no longer depend on gossip to enforce social rules for really any purpose. So now we have gossip as a form of entertainment. We're still gossiping. We're still doing this kind of thing. But we're putting it out there online. We're putting it out there in the mass media. We're essentially making, you know, little mini shows of ourselves that people can flick through and choose this channel or that channel. And they're watching that material. And so it's like we're doing all the same things that we used to do when we were, you know, living in the shtetl or the igloo or the longhouse. But we're creating permanent electronic records of this material, which is a dramatic shift into a whole different way of being human.
Yeah, but 5 years ago, YouTube was nothing. And now it's something. Is it really as permanent as you think it's going to be? Do you honestly believe that even with Web Archive, websites come and go, people forget about people? I mean, until you even brought up like the .com guy, I hadn't even thought about him for several years. And I had forgotten about him. I mean, public memory is fickle. So therefore, how does this relate to this idea of permanent records?
Well, I mean, there's the larger public memory, and then there's the more precise public memory, and the two coincide. You know, you say, okay, you forgot about .com guy, but you didn't really forget about him. You didn't care. You weren't thinking about him. The Star Wars kid, the same thing. But for that personal individual, the Star Wars kid, who is, you know, now a guy in his 20s, He's never going to forget about that because no one else is ever going to really forget about that. You know, it's like you can say, oh, I haven't thought about Betty and Veronica in a long time. That doesn't mean that you've erased those characters from your mind. It doesn't mean that if you actually ran into the Star Wars kid, the first thing you wouldn't say is, hey, you're the Star Wars kid,
yeah.
Right? So, I mean, one of the implications, of course, is that for the actual person, the goat, you know, that's with them for the rest of their lives. They have no opportunity to ever erase that in any possible way. And that, you know, that's obviously one of the dangers of when we start to make entertainment out of the everyday doings of other people.
Yeah, but some people, as you point out, have managed to actually get lucre and careers and the like out of these accidental moments.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, I would argue, are capable of accepting it. I know there was a lawsuit in the Star Wars kids case, but nevertheless, I mean, is it really so bad to be called the Star Wars kid? For one thing, when I saw that video, I actually related to it more than ridiculing it, because it's like, we've all done silly things like that in the privacy of our own homes. And I actually kind of felt bad for the kid, and he was not without his defenders. I mean, you're essentially sort of looking at something like the Star Wars kid and suggesting that everybody's out there humiliating him, but when that video got around, there were people who were defending him, saying, yeah, and that's why he was remixed. There were remixes in homage to the Star Wars kid, like, you know, mixing him with other Star Wars figures. I saw a lot of those on YouTube. So,
well, this is exactly it. We're defending him, we're debating him as if he was a fictional character. And we're saying, oh, you know, he's cool, he's not cool, we like what he does, he invokes sympathy in me. But he's not a fictional character, he's a real person, and he was not compensated for the entertainment that he provided, you know, the 100 million people who have watched the Star Wars kid all over the world. So, you know, it's a completely different way to look at human life, to say that now we can look at these videos of people and debate them the way we might debate the actions of a character in a movie. You know, I don't think that, you know, I didn't believe that plot point. You know, and it's very much the same on reality TV, of course. So we're discussing their capacity to provide us entertainment and the judgments they make, and it's all very entertaining. But somewhere down the line, there's a real person there, right?
Yeah, of course there is. However, I just told you that I actually empathized with him as a real person, because we've all been there. It was a common experience. I didn't view him as some fictitious character. I knew damn well, even though I can't remember the kid's name, Rhea's name.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he is known as the Star Wars kid, and that's the sort of common theme here. But nevertheless, not everybody is out there fictionalizing a character. And not only that, you can make the same case about, like, say, like, Hal Niedzwiecki. I mean, Hal Niedzwiecki wrote this book, and I suppose I could write fan fiction about him. Doesn't necessarily mean that that I'm not empathizing with his feelings.
Well,
it could be a celebration of Hal Niedzwiecki.
I mean, first of all, I would argue that everything put out through the mass media in this way, it becomes, you know, you immediately become a character. So there is no, you know, you couldn't possibly sympathize with him as a person, because to you, he's a character no matter what, you know, no matter what anyone wants to claim. These are characters on the screen, right? And that's who they are to us.
You're saying I can't empathize with you, Hal?
Well, you're sitting right across from me.
We're having a conversation. I thought we were having this is more than just a conversation.
I'm talking about anyone's relationship to anyone else that they encounter through the computer screen.
Yeah, but see, when I go ahead and take this conversation, I'm going to be looking at it through a computer screen, and therefore I can't empathize with that conversation. I can't actually.
Problem. No, I mean, I, you know, that's my perspective.
Your perspective
is that people really are in the when they're on the screen, they can't, you know, we empathize with them, but we empathize with them the way we empathize with fictional characters. We do not truly empathize with them as people.
So if you take a picture of a friend or a loved one and you see it on a screen, you can't possibly empathize with that particular person when you see it on a screen? That's what I'm trying to sort of figure out here.
Oh, well, that's a whole different thing, because you already know that person as a friend or a loved one.
Yeah.
I'm talking about if I took a picture of a friend or a loved one and I posted it online, say I did a little video of, you know, whoever, my kid doing something really funny, and I post it online to YouTube, and you see it, to you, that's a character. That's not a person. That's a character providing you entertainment.
Yeah. Your loved one, you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To me, it's a whole different thing, of course.
Well, see, I don't agree with that, because what if I were to meet that person later, and then I could say, oh, that person's a part of this person's life. How is that a character?
Yeah,
I
mean,
that's
ever to meet that person later, then that relationship would be altered. But
the vast
majority of people are never going to meet anyone that they, you know, they're never going to meet the Star Wars kid. Those 100 million people are never going to meet the Star Wars kid.
Star Wars kid, friend, loved one of Hal Niedzwiecki. If you don't meet them, there's no way you could possibly empathize. That's your
conviction. No, I'm not saying you can't empathize with them. I'm saying that you empathize with them in the same way you empathize with a fictional character, which is a different kind of empathy, and it's a different kind of relationship. And this gets to really the core of my argument, which is that, you know, when I sat down with the guys in San Francisco who started Twitter, and this was a couple of years ago before Twitter, you know, broke the 10 million user mark and Oprah started Twittering. We were talking about why people would use Twitter. And at that time, it was still kind of in a way, a fringe. It was on like the fringe edge of peep culture. And one of them said to me, the appeal of Twitter is that it's connection with low expectation. And that phrase really stuck with me, because I think that's very true of a lot of this material we're putting out there. We're sort of pretending to connect to each other, but we don't really expect anything from each other. We're making cyber communities where nobody really is responsible for anybody else. You know, I can blog about how I broke my leg, and I will get, you know, 100 notes of sympathy. But who's actually going to come over and, you know, bring me some soup? Nobody. And that, you know, so we have this move toward connection without expectation that is fostered by peep culture, and it's a shift in how we perceive community and friendship and individuality.
But what makes an email of sympathy any different from, say, a Precambrian letter of sympathy? I mean, sort of letter of like, hey, I'm sorry this happened to you. How are you doing? I mean, to me, I don't see much of a difference. I mean, is that still peep culture? Like, say, sending a snail mail letter of sympathy before the internet?
Well, I mean, you generally would not be sending a letter to someone that you had never met around the world, right?
Like, pen pals,
it just—it's just—it there's no comparison, because it never happened. It was never like this. You know, the only real comparison you could have is maybe like fan letters sent to celebrities in the early days of TV. There really is no comparison where total random strangers from around the world would send notes of sympathy to another totally random person that they'd never met anywhere else.
But those notes of sympathy could eventually lead to friendships by phone, by in person, and the like. Therefore, it then transcends mere celebrity culture.
Yeah,
that's why I'm wondering why it's so bad. I'm not
saying it's so bad. I mean, I'm saying that these are some of the issues that peep culture raises. I'm not saying that all of these things are leading to the apocalypse. I'm saying that we're looking at shifts in morals, shifts in values that peep culture is giving rise to. And one of those shifts is the fact that we are moving into this age of pseudo-connection, where we sort of, you know, we add and discard friends, so-called friends in quotes, and connect with people kind of momentarily as we pass through their lives. We maybe enjoy reading a blog post about how they broke their leg and how much it hurt and how screwed they are now because they have to get around in crutches and they can't go on in their job as a bike courier. And then we might post to that blog and say, oh, dude, so sorry about your leg. And then we move on. In some rare cases, in some lesser cases, we make... that might be the portal by which we make a real connection to someone else. However, I think that's less likely than the move on, which is, you know, more what we see.
To offer a Venn diagram, I'm glad you brought up Facebook, because I would agree with you that being a friend with someone on Facebook does not necessarily mean that you are a friend in real life.
God, and Ed agrees with me.
I do agree with you. we have points of commonality here. But there's a difference between, I suppose, like a bulletin board-like system, which is, of course, where the internet came from, BBSs, on a blog, and then there's a difference between the immediacy and the sort of anyone can be a friend, even someone who you talked with for 2 minutes can be your Facebook friend. I deleted my Facebook profile, Hal. I will tell you that. I did it. It was too much for me. And this leads me to also question your Facebook party, because here you have a situation in which one person showed up, and you announced it through Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
However, I would say that I'm not certain I actually accept the terms of your experiment, because, as we all know, on Facebook, you are bombarded by endless messages upon messages. You can't actually organize the inbox. You have to basically either delete or keep the message. And not only that, but it's also totally different from, like, say, an email or an Evite, which is a far more reliable measure or metric with which, you know, someone actually shows up or not. So I'm curious if it's really fair for you to condemn what you're referring to as peep culture, if the terms are entirely different from how most people organize events. I've organized events too, like just with random people. We've got like hundreds of people to show up for things by email, by Evite, and it's a lot of fun, and you meet people. So
right, but I wasn't using Evite. I mean, I deliberately wasn't using Evite or email. I was using Facebook. Those were the those are the terms I set myself to see what would happen, right?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously there would be other ways to connect with people and to hold events. However, those were not the ways that I wanted. I wanted to see what would happen if I had a Facebook party inviting my Facebook friends.
Yeah, and it makes for an amusing New York Times article. However, I would think that if you're going to go ahead and explore peep culture, you would look at it from many different forms of organizing social gatherings through the internet in order to be fair and constructive, I suppose, instead of just condemning it like nobody loves me. And I understand. I mean, you know, it's kind of debilitating to not have people show up to a cool little bar thing, you know, particularly when you're offering to buy them drinks. But
yeah, no, I mean, it you can compare it to all kinds of different things, and I certainly don't. I don't use that argument as a portal to then say that the internet can never be used to mobilize people or to talk to your friends. That's not what I claim at all. I'm simply using it as a way to say, here is a very concrete example of an attempt to foster friendship through Facebook, a social networking website that is theoretically exists to bring us closer together and so on and so forth. And it was done with completely genuine intentions, and it failed. Which to me that was a way into looking at what we're really using a lot of this material for, and I think that's completely valid. It's not a condemnation of the internet or other ways that people can get together online, like people use up meetup.org and other places that work great. Not every single thing on the internet is a manifestation of peep culture either.
But don't genuine intentions require a genuine network, like say email or Evite or something else, or even phone calls or whatnot? That's what I'm asking.
I mean,
just for the terms of the experiment.
Most people think that Facebook is a genuine network, that their Facebook friends are a genuine network. How is Facebook less genuine than, you know, if I have a list of 600 emails?
We're talking about degrees of social networks. I mean, we're talking about, okay, someone who is your Facebook friend, I think everybody can understand that that's a certain level of connection. Tertiary, but it is nevertheless some modest level of connection. Now, if you get to know that person, maybe you're an email buddy. Maybe if you get to know them even more, you hang out with them. See what I'm saying there? I think what we're maybe what we're talking about, not so much as peep culture, as the internet has essentially caused social connection to be, I suppose, shipped into this kind of degrees of social connection, as opposed to something absolute, which you seem to be arguing for in this book.
Well, there's always been degrees of social connection in human life. That's not, you know, and so obviously that's going to play out on the internet. That's not my point or my interest at all. My interest is, what are we really using certain kinds of sites, which I identify as portals into peep culture, what are we really using them for? Are we really using them as friendship, as networking, as community? Or are we using them as entertainment? Or are we using them, as I really do sort of think, that we're using them for both things at once, and that those things tend to mesh together and get pretty strange.
But here's the question. I mean, isn't this a sort of like person-to-person definition? Like, for example, you chronicle your experience tracking your wife on GPS Stitch. Of the surveillance, you write, why did she stop? What was she doing? I was annoyed that I knew where she was, but not why she was there. Suddenly, I was filled with a desire to want to know everything there is to know about the whereabouts of my wife and my child. I'd only been using the device for a day, but the experience of tracking my wife to work was proving itself to be totally addictive. Every hour or so, I logged back on and checked on her. She's still there, still at work. Where else would she be? I read this, and I said to myself, I'm sure Hal trusts his wife. I mean, you know, constantly checking the GPS to see where she is, that seems to me a rather extraordinary thing to do because, I mean, you know, with our partners, we should be trusting them and not even worrying about where they are. So why give in to this? Or, I mean, I'm sure you don't feel this way, really. Unless this was intended as a satirical kind of, like, you know, rhetoric. I don't know.
Not at all. It was an actual response to plugging into this technology. And what I realized from doing that experiment is just how incredibly addictive some of these peep culture devices are. That, you know, once we have them, we really do start to feel like, oh, I'll just check up. It has nothing to do with trust. It has to do with your own, the way that people kind of internalize these things. If you can do it, then you will do it. And then you get sort of get used to it. I talk to parents who put their kids into daycares that have webcams where they can go online and see their kids in the daycare through the webcam. And they said to me, oh, you know, at first I thought I would never use it. And then all of a sudden I found that I couldn't stop using it, that I would keep looking over and over again, which is a very similar thing. My point is that once we start using these surveillance technologies, they quickly become a kind of habit, a kind of pastime, even an entertainment for us, and that kind of, you know, washes away whatever original intention we have. And furthermore, we start to want more and more and more information. Yeah. Along these lines.
But you're using the term we, and I'm not certain that everybody would be wanting to check on their wife or their partner every hour on the hour like you did. Maybe that was your reaction, but how can you apply a sort of broad definition of what a technology like GPS Stitch, assuming that one would want it, would do to each individual person? Maybe someone might check it like every couple of days or something. You know, it's not necessarily, it's like, you know, it's like you pulled out an iPhone just now. It's like you have a whole bunch of iPhone apps on your phone, you're not going to use them all.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I am not a funded academic who can commission $2 million studies on this. These are my theories. These are my conclusions based on the interviews I've done, on the personal experiences I've had. And, you know, that's the way I write. That's the way I think. Obviously, there are lots of exceptions to anything. You know, you could say... You can nitpick any argument that anyone ever makes about a large number of people and how they respond to things. But overall, I feel my conclusions are fundamentally sound and apply to a large swath of the population. And you apply it in different ways. Not everyone would react necessarily to this particular GPS tracking device in that specific way. But we see this kind of slow ramping up of these kinds of technologies in our lives. So we get more and more used to them, more and more people are using them, more and more aggressively, and that's undeniable.
You chronicle your dad having to deal with his insurance company and how this information was traded without his particular permission. However, so there's something very interesting I saw when I went to Broken Pencil today. You write about this aspiring filmmaker who sent you an email basically saying, hey, can you remove this review because this reflects who I was in the past. I went to Broken Pencil today. I saw that review was still there.
The name is gone.
The name is gone. But, oh, I see. So, but still, there are degrees here of like, well, if the information still exists, someone can put two and two together and find that information elsewhere. So I'm wondering, you know, isn't this a little bit hypocritical to some degree?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, it's the story of that basically is that someone contacted me and they basically had a zine that they did when they were a teenager, and the zine has, you know, makes off-color remarks about kiddie porn and the kind of adolescent humor, and the review kind of mentions this, and so the review goes on to Broken Pencil's site, gets archived into Google and all these places, and this kid hits adulthood, starts applying for jobs, all the employers now Google they Google their prospective employees to see what comes up. What was coming up for him, top of the list, was this review. So he contacted me and said, you know, can you please take this review down? It's screwing up my life. So we took his name off of it, which solves the problem. Yes, if you hired some sort of private detective or something to dig deep into the Google cache and everything, you could probably find the remnants of the old post with his name attached. But the fact is that employees Google once to see what comes up. His name will no longer be attached to that review, and the problem is solved. I don't want to start deleting the Broken Pencil archives and ruining the record of zines that we've reviewed over the last 10 years every time someone doesn't like it. I mean, we also have lots of requests from people who say, take my review down, I don't like that review. And it's like, well, too bad. We have a right to write critically about what other people create.
Yeah, but simultaneously, this gets into the same argument that your dad has in terms of what the nature of his traffic violation is. That is an entirely subjective viewpoint from the viewpoint of the insurance company and from the viewpoint of your father. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it doesn't seem to me all that different. Likewise, I'm glad you brought up private investigators. They were digging up dirt as long as they have been around. I mean, you could pay anyone enough money and they can go ahead and find all the various connections. So I'm not certain if it's really so much peep culture as it is this overall moral argument to this moral position that has been long been part of human existence.
Oh, it's a total shift. I talked to this private investigator, Stephen Rambam, he basically told me that in the past, if you wanted to find out a lot of information about someone, you would have to hire a guy like him and pay him quite a large sum of money to trail him, to take his picture, to take video of him, to find out everything there is about him. Now, it's all the work is done online, and he very quickly can assemble that information that used to take him months to get, he can assemble in a day. So obviously there's a big shift. You know, you can now go to netdetective.com and pay $40 to get a complete dossier on someone. This is not something that you could have done 5 or even 10 years ago. So, you know.
Actually, as it turns out, I worked for a private detective agency about 10 years ago in the sort of pre-Cambrian internet, pre-internet times, and you actually could pay for about $70. You can get their driver's license, social security number, everything.
Well.
So, I mean, I'm wondering, if the time has become more instantaneous, the impulse is still going to be there for the truly obsessive person to find out everything they can about one individual. But nevertheless, I'm wondering if we're possibly overstating, you know, this is where we get into an argument about our own egos, because are we possibly overstating, you know, why someone would be curious about us? I mean, yes, I think you're right that on a basic level, people are probably going to Google search your name. But simultaneously, if it's about something you did like 10 years ago, well, that person could then ask you about it and say, hey, I saw this, what's this all about? And you could say, oh, well, you know, this is who I was then, I'm not who I am now. Okay, you get the job, you know what I mean?
Well, it would be nice if life worked like that, but it doesn't, because what happens is an employer has a stack of prospective hires, or the same goes with a college admissions officer and lots of other judges trying to determine what kind of sentence they might lay down, and all kinds of situations where these judgments are being made, and people are simply pulling up what's on the computer and saying, "Oh, okay, they're out. Next. You know, they're not. You know, sure, if they were to call to the person up and say, "Can you explain this particular situation?" then that would be great, but that's not what's happening. People do make these snap judgments based on what's on the internet.
Not always, of course. Forgiveness
always.
And empathy and understanding is amazing human qualities.
Yeah, that's lovely. Unfortunately, we live in a bureaucratic capitalist society where people are trying to get certain things done quickly, and they're trying to. They're not worried about forgiveness or redemption. They're just simply looking for whatever traits that they're looking for to make a decision, and any excuse helps them to decide about somebody instantaneously. There's so many applicants that's, you know, they can just move on.
Well, like, say something like a wiki or Wikipedia or whatnot. I mean, here you have a number of people arguing about a topic or even an individual, and this constantly is subject to change and subject to, I suppose, peer review. So I'm wondering if you're possibly understating the capacity for various people to come together and say, well, hey, that person's not a bad guy, or this person did this and this person did this. I mean, you know, it seems to me that your book... My basic problem with your book, although I do think it's interesting, is the fact that you tend to slant more towards this humiliation idea. And I'm here to tell you that people are pretty positive too. They're willing to defend things. They're willing to go ahead and uphold virtue.
Well, I mean, you're just we're conflating a lot of different arguments here. If you're looking at Wikipedia, what I'm talking about is a clash of values. There are the values of the new kind of web 2.0 age, and they are the values of the traditional bureaucratic, individualist, achievement-oriented society that still maintains pretty much its power over us. And those two different values are constantly clashing, and we're seeing that in many different ways. So, you know, there's two different kind of spheres developing here, and they're in conflict with each other.
But as you point out near the end of the book, there are good aspects of this. For example, showing cops tase people.
Absolutely.
You know, this is terrible. In fact, in London, there is a law that is prohibiting any citizen from photographing cops. And there was that guy who was trampled at the G20 protest, you know, not long ago. And had not a camera been there to capture that particular moment, we would not have known about that brutal moment. So you're dealing with some interesting aspects, and I think it could be a positive force as well.
For sure.
Like anything.
Throughout the book, I make points about the positive nature of these of aspects of peep culture. There's no question. There's a lot of positive elements. However, I still maintain that for every video that we capture of say someone in authority abusing their authority, we produce 20,000 videos of a drunk girl pissing herself. And then proceeding to vomit on the toilet floor, which we then post to YouTube and you know, create ripples of permanent embarrassment. So, you know, I'm not saying good, bad, yes or no. I'm saying these are the realities of what we're doing, and people have to think about it and make choices.
But isn't that Sturgeon's law? 90% of everything is crap. I mean, that applies to every single medium. I mean, there's good and there's bad, and there's the top 10% that makes life worth living.
Well,
I'm a bit of a cheerier person than you are, I think. I don't know.
I mean, I'm glad that you have this optimism, but I unfortunately don't share it, and I think that the evidence of what you find on the internet does not bear out the kindness of people, their willingness to forgive and forget, their capacity for empathy and shared communal relationships. What we are seeing is people using other people's misfortunes and humiliations, and even their happinesses, and it's for their entertainment. And a lot of times that turns out badly, or it turns out in ways that we never could have imagined. In some cases, it turns out very well for all involved, or it reveals something about society that we all needed to know. But in the vast majority of cases, we are dehumanizing ourselves, we are creating alienation, we are creating separation from each other. And I think that the evidence does not point to a positive viewpoint.
I would argue that if people found this conversation entertaining and it actually caused your book to become a huge bestseller, this would be a very positive development.
Well, we are not engaged in peep culture here. We're engaged in discussion of ideas, which is a completely different thing.
But the listener listening to this, is it possible that the listener listening to this, any listener who doesn't know me, doesn't know you, is a peeper? Is that your position?
No, not at all. I mean, You're making it sound like anything that ever goes on the internet and is listened to by anyone is somehow compromised, which is not my point at all. My point, is the way that people are using personal revelations about their lives and the quotidian details of their existence as entertainment for other people, and other people are taking that material and entertaining themselves with it. So, I mean, we're having a very interesting, thoughtful conversation, which really has nothing to do with producing peep culture. Now, if you started to ask me about my masturbation habits, then we start delving into peep culture.
Okay. Well, I'll ask you that off mic.
Yeah, you do that.
Hal, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you, as always.
All right. Thanks, man. We'll see you in 4 years.
Yeah, I'm breaking it down. Man, this is what it feels like when I'm breaking it down.
Breaking it down, keep breaking it down.
It's not my fault. It's not my fault. I'm hot, man. It's not my fault. It's not my fault. Till the sun comes up. Every night, we party here, we party till daylight. We be getting it in, come on, we getting it in. Little Hennessy, a little juice and gin. It's not a fantasy, it's not pretend. We gon' do it, we gon' do it, we gon' do it again. Till the sun comes up every night.